Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Christopher Levins about his book, King Cheongjo, An Enlightened Despot in Early Modern Korea. Chris, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I finished my PhD in 2014, and I was getting ready to developed my first book proposal, and I got a one-year visiting professorship at Oberlin College. And so one of the things you have to do when you're interviewing for the job is meet all the different faculty, and I was going around meeting people and talking about various aspects of my work, and I ran into one of the professors there who asked me about my dissertation, in which I had said that King Cheongjo was not an absolute ruler. And she said, well, what do you mean when you say absolute or absolutism? What are you talking about? And I kind of filibustered some kind of non-answer to escape the question because I realized I didn't know, really. I just had this, like, well, absolutism. I mean, we know, like, it's Louis XIV and, like, let them eat cake and, you know, this kind of stuff. Yeah, we know what absolutism is. But then I kept the fact that I didn't know the answer to that question while I was trying to turn my dissertation into a useful book, because it's an acceptable dissertation, which means it's boring. So I have to try to turn it into something that might be a little more interesting to people. And I was like, well, what is absolutism really? I mean, what do you really mean when you say that? And so I started to look into the theoretical work that had been done on it. And there were two things I took away. One thing was nobody really knows what absolutism is, or there's no consensus on it. And also, by whatever criteria most people would accept as absolutist, well, then, in my judgment, Cheongjo kind of was. So I decided, okay, well, I guess that's the book then, is actually to essentially argue against myself. I'm now going to take my dissertation and say, by the way, I got it wrong, actually. And by these criteria, Cheongjo actually could be considered an absolute ruler. So that's what I spent the rest of my time in that job doing. And then I got a postdoc after that, which basically was the finally preparing the final manuscript. And so, yeah, that's kind of how the book came together.
Hmm. It's a fascinating book because you're engaging with your subject on several different levels. You're talking about him within the context of the ideas about absolutism, 18th century governance, but you're also talking about him, obviously, as a figure in Korean history, and you're engaging with the historiography of your subject, which I thought was pretty interesting as well. I was wondering, though, to start us off in terms of discussing Cheongjo and, you know, his status as an absolute ruler, if you could tell us a little bit about him and what 18th century Korea was like. You know, to what degree was it similar to the other areas of Asia, the areas of the West that you sometimes compare him to as a ruler?
Yeah, so those are two really interesting questions. I'll go in order. So the first one about Changzhou himself, he actually had quite an interesting childhood, in that his father was executed by the king, who would have been his grandfather, which is extremely unusual in Joseon, Korea. So that's that was the name of the country. So whenever the ruling family of Korea changed, the name of the country was also changed. So when Changzhou's family, which is the Yi family, the royal Yi clan, or Lee, often Koreans will say Lee instead of Yi. So, you know, like Syngman Rhee, the first president of South Korea, is also not the same family, but the same name. So that family, when they were ruling the country, was called Joseon. And so in Joseon, you know, unlike, say, you know, medieval England, where there was constant warfare between fathers and sons over the control of the country, over who's going to be the next king, in Joseon it was usually very orderly, a very orderly succession. You know, there might be challenges between half brothers, but you know, a son would never challenge his father for the throne. It's just kind of unheard of. So the fact that the king, who would be Changzhou's grandfather, had Changzhou's father executed is very unusual. And not only was it unusual, but it was carried out in a very unusual way. So instead of just, you know, saying off with his head or something and condemning it as a traitor, because in the Joseon royal family, the king ruled in part because he was moral, or his clan was supposed to be a moral example for the entire nation. So if the if Changzhou's father had been executed as a criminal or as a traitor, whether he was or not, is immaterial. If he had been so executed in that way, it would have tarnished Changzhou. It would have made it impossible for him to take the throne, because he would also have been the son of a traitor. So the king had to kill his own son, which is already a tragedy in Joseon, and then he had to do it in a very roundabout kind of way to try to avoid the stigma of criminality. So instead of just having him executed in a traditional way, which would have been either asking to take or demanding that he take poison, or having him strangled, he instead locked him inside a chest of rice. I mean, there's no rice in it, but it's a chest that you would use to store rice. So he ordered him to go inside of this chest, and it was then sealed and simply left outside. And so Changzhou's father, who was the prince of the country, he was the crown prince, he would have been, was supposed to be the next king, essentially starved to death, right, and died of exposure, locked inside of a box sitting in the outside of the palace. And Changzhou was actually there when this order was, slightly before this order was carried out. And so he was about 10 years old. So he had to be physically dragged out of the palace because, you know, the king was raging. He was raging at Changzhou's father about what a failure he was and how he should kill himself, because if he committed suicide, then he wouldn't be a criminal. So he said, "You should kill yourself. You would spare all of us all of this pain." And the whole time, Changzhou was there, 10 years old, like wondering why his grandfather screaming at his father to kill himself. So he had to be physically dragged, you know, crying and screaming, out of the palace. And so because he was only 10 years old when this happened, he didn't really understand what had happened. You know, he didn't really understand why his father was executed. And his father was executed because he was insane. He had probably been driven mad through constant abuse at the hands of the king, Changzhou's grandfather. And so he had started doing all kinds of terrible things. He'd started getting really drunk. He had started dressing in military uniform, which the king of Joseon usually didn't do. The king of Joseon was the head of the army, but he wasn't supposed to act like it. He was supposed to look like a scholar. So he would, you know, the prince would put on this armor and like march around as if he's in a military formation, but he's all alone. Like there's no one there, and he's like marching around. And then he started going into rages and killing people. And so that's why, and he probably threatened his father's life. Like he probably said, I'm going to kill my father because I hate him, who was the king of the country. So you can't do that. So he had to be executed for those reasons. But Changzhou probably didn't really know that. Because he was only 10. So he didn't really understand what had happened. So he always thought that his father had been killed by factional infighting, by, you know, different cliques in the government who had deceived him and who had deceived the king into this tragedy of having his son killed. And so I think that when Chongzhou himself became king, his overall goal was, I'm not going to let that happen to me. I'm not going to be manipulated. I'm not going to be fooled by these cliques and these factions into doing something terrible, like what had happened to his father. And then that sort of ties in with the second question, which is, you know, what was 18th century Korea like? It was a time of relative prosperity, relative commercial development, relative security and stability throughout the country. So it's generally considered kind of the last golden age before, or at least a nice age, if not golden, before the 19th century, which is considered to be a time of decline in Korean history, which then led to Korea becoming a Japanese colony in the beginning of the 20th century. So many Koreans, when they look back at the history of their country, the 18th century and Chongzhou's time is kind of the last time when we can still really be proud of our country and its accomplishments. And it was a good time, but still Korea was behind China and Japan. It was improving commercially. It was doing better than it had ever done before. But still, Korea was still underpopulated. It was still kind of economically backward. It wasn't strongly integrated into the larger trading networks that you had throughout East Asia. So even then, it was still a minor player. And that's kind of sort of a snapshot of what the 18th century looked like.
The context in which you've just placed Korea gets to this interesting question about absolutism, because we talk about it oftentimes in ways that cross national boundaries, that kind of assume a generalized sense of political thinking. I was wondering if you could perhaps take us to talking about, you know, how you frame absolutism in the 18th century, and then how it applies both to Chongzhou and to how he sought to govern.
Yeah, it's kind of a something that I am hoping to do with this project is to get another side of absolutism out there. Even if people reject my central claim, which is certainly a debatable claim. I mean, I'm not claiming to have a slam dunk case, but even if people don't, you know, accept my central thesis that Chongzhou was an absolute monarch, I still think it's valuable to ask the question and to show, you know, here's whatever we think absolutism is, which I was surprised at how little agreement there was when I looked into the sort of scholarly literature on absolutism. But I still think Korea can be a good test case of, okay, let's take these concepts and put them somewhere we haven't put them before and then see how they stack up. Because you've really, when you talk about absolutism, it really goes back to two. We think like Louis XIV and 16th, 17th century France, and then there's China. And so, you know, when I was a grad student and when I was, you know, doing my PhD and even when I did my dissertation, I was a good little grad student. So I just pretty much accepted what I was taught, which is that the Korean monarchy was weak. And what I think I've gathered from this is that when you talk about pre-modern Korea, Korea before it becomes a Japanese colony, any comparative statement you make, the unspoken and sometimes I think even unconscious comparison that you're making is with China. So if you say Korea's strong or weak militarily, if you say it's more or less devoted to Confucianism, if you think it's more or less commercially developed, whatever the comparative that you're making, you're possibly unconsciously comparing it to China. And so when you look at the Korean monarchy compared to the Chinese monarchy, then yes, the Korean monarchy was weak because the Chinese monarch had the kind of absolute power that we often think the French kings had. And even then, probably not even quite that much. But they are actually closer to when you think of the French king just acting on a whim and get throwing caution to the wind and ignoring what anybody else wants and just having people executed because they looked at him funny. That's much more characteristic of what you could get in China. And even then, there's, you know, it's not quite that extreme, but you could get closer to that. You know, the Chinese emperor could have the highest, most respected officials in the land just beaten in front of him. He could essentially have any of them executed without any real challenge other than please don't do that. But there's no real way that they could, any real thing that they could do to stop it. When I looked at Chongzhou and then I looked into the work on European quote unquote absolutism or despotism, it started to look much more similar there. I'm thinking, okay, this is much more like what I'm used to. Absolutism, which is essentially that there's theoretically no limit to the king's power. Theoretically, all of the power throughout the country ultimately goes back to the king. So anybody else exercising power is only doing so because the king has so delegated it to them. But in practice, you don't really have that level of complete freedom of action. I mean, there's expectations on you. There's an understanding of the way things have traditionally been done that if you try to act outside of that, you're going to get your hand slapped because the king is never the only political actor. There's always other people that have their own followers. They have their own respect that they can command, their own resources they can command. And so what you end up getting is a good absolute monarch is the opposite of that. A good absolute monarch is actually a consensus builder, essentially. They've gotten the other power players to be on board with it, to say, hey, supporting me as the king, not opposing me, not trying to thwart what I'm trying to do, that's good for you too. And that's why you should do it. You know, you end up coming out ahead in all of this. And I think that's what happened in the so-called absolute polities in Europe. And I think that's what happened in Korea. And that's why I think, you know, in the end, it's a useful case. And in my estimation, you can't say that Chongzhou had the kind of power the Chinese emperor did, but I think you could say he roughly had about the same amount of power that, say, Louis XIV did. So if, I guess in the end, what it comes down to is if the one is absolutism, then the other is too. So if you're going to apply that label, it has to be applied to both. And if you don't like the label for one, then you would also have to reject it for the other.
It's one of the things you do in your book that I thought was really interesting was how you show how the idea of absolutism worked in practice, and you sort of take the court, you take the factionalism which continued to exist during his reign, and you show how that concept played out. And I'd like to start by talking a bit about that concept there, because you start talking about it, is you go into the political thinking of the time. What were the political ideas about monarchy that Chongzhou had to work with, and which ones did he use in terms of realizing his vision of what he wanted his monarchy to be?
Okay, so for the first part, we'll talk about it more generally, which I think applies for everybody. And then the second part, we can kind of get down to the Confucian aspect of it, which is primarily what he used, Chongzhou used, because he was in a Confucian polity. For the first part, essentially it was, you know, today, hopefully, of course, you know, we look around the United States and it's not looking so much like this is the case in this particular historical moment. But generally speaking, in the modern world, it becomes acceptable to disagree, essentially, to say we are two groups of people that both have the best interest of the country or the state or the people, or you know, however you want to phrase it. We both have the best interest at heart. What we disagree on is the effectiveness. You know, I think this policy is the best for everybody or for most people. And you disagree, but you don't disagree because you're a bad person or because you have a secret agenda. You disagree simply because you think that my method won't work and you have a better method that you think. And then we, in the public forum of ideas, we argue about this and we try to persuade people that one or the other of our group has the better idea. You know, in the 18th century, anywhere in the world, just about. That's not how things went. When two groups disagreed, the group, you know, one group would say, well, basically, we're right because we understand the world and what's going on. And those people over there, they're bad. They are not disagreeing because they have a true disagreement, because, you know, reasonable men, to use that term, can disagree. No, they're actually just out. They're just in it for themselves. They're trying to oppose what we want to do, which is would be better for everybody, because it's not good for them, and they just want, you know, to get a larger slice of the pie for themselves. And so, absolute theorists, the reason that they thought that absolutism was good, you know, I mean, obviously the king thinks, oh, absolutism is great because it means everybody has to listen to me. But why did these, you know, people around them think it was a good idea? Well, they thought because the king is the only one who can arbitrate these claims. I mean, if you allow people to vote, or if you allow these different cliques and factions to work it out themselves, what you're going to have is anarchy. They're just going to fight each other over it because they're not really disagreeing over policy. They're disagreeing over personal pettiness and bickering because men are weak, essentially. And if you hand it over to the mob, you know, if you try to have some kind of voting or something, well, that brings on the common people, and they don't have any mentality. They're easily misled. So that's just anarchy. The choice is between rule by a benevolent prince or mob rule. That's kind of the way that they thought. So they would argue what you need is a king who can cut through all the BS, who can say to all of these factions, you know, you can make your case to me, but I'm going to decide what's best for the country. And I'm the one who actually has the real interests of the country at heart. And I can override factions, and I can just ignore all of this petty bickering and get to the heart of the matter. And that was pretty much, in a more sophisticated way, that's the essence of what they were arguing. So that's why they thought that one man rule was better. You know, we generally look on it now as being a bad thing because, you know, one person being in charge, you know, they can just indulge their petty grievances and they can just ignore important problems that people bring up. But in the 18th century, they thought that somebody like that is what you want because, you know, they don't have to argue with anybody. They don't have to go through committees to get anything done. They make a decision. They know what's up. They say, let's do it, and you do it. And anybody who doesn't like that, anybody who says, well, despotic rule is bad, what they're doing is blocking the king's attempts to make society better. And that's why you shouldn't do it. So when you shift over to Korea, you get a lot of the same arguments from those who supported a stronger kingship. They pretty much say it straight out. I mean, there's a scholar called Tasan. That's his pen name. So that's the name everybody knows. That's the name he primarily wrote under. One of the greatest philosophers in the history of pre-modern Korea, very prolific scholar. He wrote on pretty much every subject that exists. And he essentially wrote, those who block the king's will are essentially blocking the king's ability to bestow upon the people the blessings that only the king can provide. So the implication there, the other side of that he doesn't bother to say because everybody would understand it, is you shouldn't block the king. You should simply allow him to rule in the way that he sees fit. And so Cheongjo himself, with the way he promoted Tasan, he liked Tasan for a lot of reasons, and he protected him to an extent from his enemies, partly because he's writing this stuff and he's expressing these opinions. Let the king do what he wants. Well, that's what Cheongjo is looking for, somebody who will do that. And Cheongjo also exploited something called Guan, which is the Korean pronunciation of this Chinese character that originally meant weighing, as in like a scale, you know, weighing the for a transaction, for a, you know, buying and selling. You know, you weigh the amount of bronze or copper or silver or whatever to get the appropriate amount of rice or something. And so, you know, metaphorically, that ended up becoming judgment. You know, it's because that's what judgment is weighing of options. So your discretion, your ability to look at a situation and judge the amounts and decide what the right thing to do is. And Cheongjo essentially decided that he was the sage king, who is a king that embodies Confucian virtues, and that person is therefore should be trusted to use his discretion, to use his value judgment to say, okay, here's the situation. Maybe here's what was done in the past. Here's what the law says. But I'm the Sage King, and I can weigh the situation and violate what's happened in the past, the precedent that's been set. Or I can deviate from the law when I, as a Sage King, have determined that that's the right thing to do. And he does that a number of times and openly says that, that that's what he's doing. And he says at one point, or he writes in his daily record at one point, he writes that that those who stick too closely to the law are not even worth discussing politics with, right? So he's saying right there, if you're going to say that I've got to stick to the law, then I don't even want to hear from you about politics. Because clearly you don't know what you're talking about if you don't recognize that a Sage King like me can make this value judgment and essentially violate the law when I think it's appropriate.
So the theory there is it really does grant him a lot of latitude. But as you explain, there's this gulf between the theory and the practice. The reality is that, you know, Chongzhou can't simply snap his fingers and expect everyone to fall into line. He has to weigh all the various factions and interests that are existing in his court in order to implement his will, in order to ensure that there's no dissent. And you explain in some detail exactly who these factions were and the history that exists that predated Chongzhou's birth, let alone his reign. So could you take us to that aspect of his rule of the factions that existed at his court and the degree to which they affected or challenged his vision for how he as a king should govern?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, to speak directly to what you were saying, commenting on my presentation of Chongzhou's case, you know, there was a scholar official who was a high official at the time. So this is not, you know, some joker that nobody paid attention to. This guy was a high official serving in the government, and he said, you know, you keep talking about using this discretion. He uses the very same word that Chongzhou uses, this guan, this weighing. And he says, you keep talking about you're using this discretion. And yeah, we recognize that that can be done, but that's, you know, even the Sage Kings didn't use it that often. And here you are, like, every year, you're just, like, using it more than they used it in their whole lifetime. So he certainly did not have a monopoly on the you know, political theory and you know, what we would now call political theory, you know, for presenting why he should be a ruler, because there are contradictory tendencies in Confucianism. You know, there's certainly this notion of the sage king and sage rulership and the fact that you need a king and no one should usurp the king's place. I mean, Confucius is very, very well known in the Analects for openly condemning dukes, what we translate in English as duke, the title below king in the Chinese hierarchy. For them, essentially usurping the place of the king, for ruling as the king is supposed to rule, and he says, you know, that's bad. Like, even if the king is bad, you're still not supposed to just take over and say, well, we're not going to listen to him anymore. That's not the way it's supposed to go. But there's also contradictory tendencies where the king is supposed to rule, as we've been talking about, in consultation with learned men, which means Confucian scholars, right? So you're supposed to listen to the king and do what he says and obey him, but he's also supposed to be ruling in consultation with you anyway. And there's, you know, you can look at that in different ways, right? I mean, consultation means what? Like, what if you consult with him and he ignores you? Well, then you could say, well, then you didn't consult very well, and you could, you know, criticize him in that way. And in the 18th century, you know, factionalism had existed in Chosun for about 200 years. And when we say factionalism, it's if not unique in world history, it's definitely unusual the way Korean factionalism worked, because it was not the way normally a faction arises around a particular issue or around a particular person, sometimes if it involves personal conflict. And then once that issue is resolved or becomes irrelevant through historical change or the personalities involved, you know, the central personalities die, then the factions disappear or reshuffle, and then new factions arise over a new issue. And again, the unspoken comparison is China. You look at important factions in China. And factionalism was important in China, but it you know, more generally followed this pattern. But in Joseon, it didn't go that way. In Joseon, they had a major split in 1575 between two major factions. And all of the later factions for the next 250 years all can originally trace their existence to one of those two factions, because you inherited your factional standing. You went to, you know, if you were a Yangban, which is the sort of the aristocracy of traditional Korea, especially in the Joseon period, if you were a Yangban son from a powerful Yangban family, your family would be in one of the factions, one of these, which, you know, however many there were, which descended from the original two, and you would associate only with members of your faction, even as children or going over to meet, you know, friends of your father and such. They would all be from the same faction. And then when you went to, for your education, you would have a tutor who was from your faction. And then when you were old enough to go to your private school, because the Yangban didn't go to the public schools because they weren't prestigious enough, so they had their own private schools, and the private school would be dedicated to some great leader from your faction's past. And then there you would learn the texts of Confucianism as filtered through the way your faction interpreted those classics. And you would learn also what other factions said about the Confucian classics and why they were all wrong. And when it was time for you to get married, your family would arrange a marriage for you with a woman whose family was also from your faction. So that's why these factional allegiances continue down through the generations. So even when there would be a dispute, it would cause a split between, within an existing faction, they would split into two, but they would still be considered, you know, originally part of the same parent faction. So these continue down for hundreds of years, and it would get into, you know, some stuff that, you know, we look at it now, we think it's amazing to see, like, you know, maybe your grandfather who's already dead, maybe he was executed in a previous factional purge, and then your faction comes into power and you say, not only do I want my grandfather's name to be cleared, even though he's dead, but I also want you to punish the people who falsely accuse him by demoting them from office, even though they are also dead, right? But you're still demoting them from office because you continue to respect your ancestors after their death. So you lowering their office, it lowers the whole clan's prestige. And even if it's bad enough, you even want them to be punished more harshly. And if they're already dead, well, how do you punish them more harshly? You desecrate the grave. Okay, so they would do that. So, you know, in traditional Confucianism, you're supposed to keep your body whole, right? You're supposed to die such that your body has not been horribly disfigured or damaged, because it's a gift from your parents. So that's why poison or strangulation is the quote unquote best way to die, because it means your body's whole. If you're decapitated, which is the worst form of punishment, it's kind of a curse in the afterlife. You know, it's a sin in Confucianism to have your body be damaged that way. So what they would do is they would dig up the corpses of the men who had died centuries earlier and separate the skull from the rest of the corpse just to desecrate them, right? Because they still remembered, you know, it's my great grandfather, you know, he died before I was even born, but we carried these stories down of these crimes against our family, against our faction, even down through the generations. So there's a lot of bitterness between these factions. And by the 18th century, you had what they called the four colors. That's the term they actually used at the time. They called them the four colors. But for our purposes, the fourth color we can just kind of ignore. So really there were three major factions, and there's different ways to translate the names. But the way I use is the patriarchs, the disciples, and the southerners. And the patriarchs and the disciples originally had come from the same parent faction, so they really hated each other. And the patriarchs were the ones who were usually in charge, and they were really hard line on the more traditional understanding of kingship, which is the king just sort of canvasses his ministers, who would hopefully be patriarchs themselves, and then they sort of tell him what their opinion is, and then he would basically, oh, okay, well, that's what you guys think. Well, let's do that.
You know, that's their sort of picture of kingship. And then you had the disciples, and even though they hated the patriarchs, they more or less had the same idea because they were from the same faction. And then you had the Southerners, who had been out of power by Chungzhou's time for about 100 years. So they had not been able to serve in high government positions because they had lost an earlier factional struggle. So they had some different ideas. And Tassan, who I mentioned before, he was one of these people. So they were a little more open to a stronger king because for them, what that would mean is a stronger king could get them back into power, is their real understanding. And then philosophically, their position was, as I mentioned, that the patriarchs were kind of blocking the king from doing good things. And so they, the Southerners, you know, bring us in, put us in government, and we'll kind of let you do what you want. So that's sort of the situation that Chungzhou was in. And so he tried to do that to an extent. So he got Southerners into higher positions than they'd ever had before, including the leader of the Southerner faction. He put him onto the state council, which was the highest government office that Chulsan had. And for about a year, he actually had him as the only person. So it's a council that has three slots, so the three highest officials in the land. He actually left two of them empty for about a year and put this leader of the Southerners as the only one. So essentially, he was essentially kind of serving like a prime minister, which the patriarchs were very unhappy about and spent months sending angry letters to the king saying, you can't have this guy be the only person in charge here. So it was a difficult thing to do, but he did as much as he could. And he also used special appointments, which means he appoints someone to office without a recommendation. And normally, he would have to ask the Minister of Personnel to recommend three candidates, and then he would make a choice from the three he was provided. But he often didn't like the ones that he was provided because they were all patriarchs. So he would use a special appointment to stick a Southerner in there or some other supporter of his that he liked. So those were the kind of tricks that he used to try to build a base of support for people that would accept a stronger monarchy.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I find it fascinating because he's definitely favoring one faction, and yet as you described, he comes to this with this argument or this belief that he is going to govern beyond factions. Did he ever have to rhetorically reconcile the two? Or was it just the idea that if you support him, you're above factions? If you oppose him, you're demonstrating that you are a faction.
I think he's really in to use a really outdated expression, he's really in a pickle because he's both he personally and also the circumstances of the time make that whole concept really difficult. So he implemented a policy which is called the Tangpyeong Check, which best translation, I think, is the policy of impartiality. More literally, it means the policy of kind of heavenly balance or something like that. Or grand unity makes it sound nicer. But really what it means is being above factions. But he didn't invent that policy. The previous two kings had also implemented that, though the first one who did that, it was really a misnomer, because what he meant by being above factions is he was constantly pitting the factions against each other, and a number of executions were carried out. Under his reign was a little bit bloody. But Chongdo's grandfather, the previous king, tried to do it in the way that we would actually picture it, which was trying to be above factions. But then what does that mean? You know, how can you really be above the factions when they're so ingrained in the political system? I mean, every official, pretty much, with very few exceptions, every official is a part of the factions. They're under enormous pressure to oppose the other factions for the reasons I described, because, you know, the disputes that they're having are not like you and I having a friendly dispute over policy. It's not even like, you know, AOC versus Trump. It's not even that level of disagreement between two groups. It's for centuries, your faction has been having our factional brothers executed. Never mind that for centuries, we've also been having your factional brothers executed, but of course we're right and you're wrong. So for centuries, we've been fighting you and you've been our enemies. So for somebody to come out and say, hey, let's all just get along, you're trying to turn back centuries of conflict at that point. So what does that really mean? How do you really get beyond factions? Chongdo's grandfather couldn't accomplish it in the way that we would say, which is, again, just trying to say, let's all just get along. Let's kind of ignore our factions and come together and work together for the good of the country. Chongdo knew he couldn't do that. But just as you say, well, does he build his own faction, like a pro-royal faction? Isn't that just more the same? Like, no, all I've done is add another faction to the mix. And he got accused of that. He was accused of, you know, the Tangpyeong faction, which means people that support his policy of this policy of impartiality. Oh, that's just another faction. You know, that's all you've done is now you've got a pro-king faction. It's not any different. And on top of that, I think Chongdo personally, to go back to what I was saying about his goal as king, to avoid his perception of his father's fate, which is his grandfather, the king, was manipulated by a faction into thinking his son was his enemy and therefore he had him executed, which I said is probably not what happened. He probably had him executed legitimately because he was insane and therefore could not be allowed to become the next king. It would have, you know, jeopardized the entire royal family, the entire rule of the dynasty to have essentially a madman sitting on the throne. That's the real reason, but Chongzhou probably didn't know that. He just thought what he thought happened was that a rival faction convinced the king that his son, Chongzhou's father, was his enemy and therefore had to execute him. So at the same time, he's promoting these Southerners. He himself does actually want to be above factions. It's not just that he doesn't want a pro-king faction because of what his enemies would say, which is, you're just building another faction to support you. How does that help? He didn't want any faction to think they really controlled him, or he didn't want any faction to really think that he owed them anything, because he's the king. You know, you support me because it's the right thing to do, not because you think that you support me against my enemies and then later I reward you and later you've got some leverage on me where you could say to me, you remember the time we helped you against this other faction, you know, now you owe us. You know, he's thinking, I'm the king, I sit on the throne, I don't owe anybody anything. So it's kind of the double-edged sword that he was facing that I don't think he really found a suitable solution. I don't even know if there is a suitable solution. I mean, how can you be above factions when it's so ingrained into the fabric of the political landscape? You know, how do you form a coterie of supporters that don't therefore expect to be rewarded for their support? But I think that's what he was trying to do.
The tools that he uses are very interesting. I was especially fascinated by your description of the Royal Library, which, you know, by its label, you would assume to be the most, you know, innocuous of government institutions, and yet you explain how it is just one of these tools that he uses to extend and exercise his power. How did he seek to perpetuate his power? How did he seek to turn the theory of absolutism into a governing reality?
Yeah, that was kind of the one of the interesting paradoxes of his reign. And I borrow in the book I'm not going to be able to remember the exact quotation, but it's pretty close to this. But it was a scholar talking about Louis XIV. I'm just going to put Chongzhou in place of Louis XIV, but the quote originally applies to Louis, which is that the weakness of Chongzhou's system is that it required Chongzhou to make it work. And he, I think, recognized that. You know, he died at a very young age, even for the time. He was only 48 years old. You know, we don't know that it was because of overwork, but we can be reasonably sure that he was overworked. So that may have contributed to his death at a young age. So he tried to set it up so that, you know, his successor, his son, wouldn't have to work that hard. So let's try to systematize and institutionalize this increased power for the king and this acceptance that the king is able to do this. So he doesn't have to keep getting this pushback against it. So he's tried to set up things like the Royal Library, which is purposeful in setting that up as something that is supposed to look innocuous. Though it has a very flattering name. It's in Korean, it's Kyujanggak, which means like the Hall of the Learning of Gui, which is actually a Chinese literary god, which was also used briefly in China. That exact same term, Kyujanggak, was used to describe the building that housed the writings of the Chinese emperors. And so, yes, it is supposed to. I mean, the Chinese emperor, unlike the Japanese emperor, was not considered himself to be a god, like a divine figure. But using divine terminology is supposed to, like, make the emperor look really impressive. So here is, you know, Chongzhou borrowing this term that applied to Chinese emperors to describe this, to name this institution that was, you know, intended to house the writings of the kings of Joseon, which he and his grandfather primarily, because they're the ones who had the most written material that survived. But what he did was he actually gave, because it's supposed to house the writings of kings, he had an excuse to give it, to assign relatively high-ranking officials to it, right? So, you know, why are you sending these are you giving really high rank to these people that are just librarians? Like, well, it's because they're taking care of the king's books. So, you know, you can't have a low-ranking person deal with the king's books. What that means is he's giving these people high rank, because once you, in the Joseon system, you had both rank and office. So you had these different ranks, and then you had the offices that were assigned to rank. But once you held an office of a certain rank, you had that rank, whatever number it was. So even if you were then transferred or fired and then reappointed to a lower office, an office that required a lower rank, you still kept the higher rank that you had from the previous office. Your rank, you know, so your new job might be a lower position, but the rank that you held remained from the higher position. So you always had whatever the highest rank, you know, position you'd ever had, you had the rank that went with it. So if you serve in the Royal Library, even though it in itself is not an especially impressive post, perhaps, you still got the rank that went with it, which would then make you eligible for other posts of a rank of that level. And they also had an interesting sort of power that in the Joseon government, you had, you know, the high officials that made most of the decisions. But then you had these three different government offices, but they all kind of had the same function. So scholars kind of lump them together, which often happened in Joseon. They often had all different offices that ended up having very similar functions. So we just kind of group these three offices together. We call them the censorate. And their job, they were usually younger men, and their job was to look at what the government was doing and what the government officials were doing and judge it. So they kind of sat in judgment of it according to Confucianism, according to Confucian standards. Are these guys really doing what is moral according to Confucianism? And if they didn't, then they would criticize it. They would write a letter, you know, criticizing the conduct of these officials and their policies, and write to the king expecting some kind of response. And they were considered to be permitted to do this, which is, you know, not very common in the pre-modern world. Usually you can criticize the king and his officials in private, but you don't openly condemn them. That would be considered treason. But Joseon had kind of allowed this tradition of, okay, let's have this coterie of younger men who have government positions themselves, who can engage in fruitful and helpful criticism of their superiors. And the king should, you know, allow them to reasonably air these grievances. But then the Royal Library, some of the offices in the Royal Library also had that power, but they themselves were exempt from criticism. So they were allowed to criticize everybody else, but they themselves could not be criticized in turn, which is really unusual. So that's also a sort of vehicle that Chengdu himself could use. Because we know that we had always suspected that when you submit a memorial, which is essentially a letter to the king asking for some sort of policy or asking the king to do something or asking the government to do something and explaining why you want it to be done, you have to put your name on it, and sometimes a bunch of officials would get together and they would all sign the same memorial to show their support for it. But we had always suspected that, you know, just because somebody's name is on the memorial doesn't actually mean that they wrote it. But finally, with Chengdu, we actually have some proof that that happened, because we found these letters. So we found letters from Chengdu to one of his high officials that are not the official letters, because official letters would, like a memorial that I mentioned before, a letter to the king or and his response in return, those are all recorded in the official records, so anybody could read them later. But these are, we call them secret letters because they were not sent through the official channels. They're, if you don't like secret, you could call them informal letters, which we gather the king was not supposed to do. He was not supposed to actually engage in this. All of his correspondence with his officials should have been above board, should have been in the public record. But apparently he was sending these letters, and one of the reasons that we suspect that is because of the 300 letters we have that the king wrote to this official, about a dozen of them say, tear this letter, destroy this letter after you read it. Right? So he doesn't want people to find these things, which fortunately for historians, apparently the official didn't do that. And so in these letters, he's writing that, write a memorial that says something like this, and then submit it under your name or submit it under somebody else's name. But it's actually Chongzhou's words that he's, or at least if not his words, it's this, because the king in Chulsan is supposed to react. You know, the king is not supposed to come out and say, you know what, I've been thinking and I think we should do this, right? Now, that's not what he was supposed to do. He's supposed to sit there and allow his officials to present memorials or present petitions or ideas, and then he makes a decision on them. And so one of the ways Chengdu got around that, when he wanted to do something, now that we know that he would essentially tell one of his supporters, or at least somebody that owed him a favor or something, to present an idea or a policy that he could then rule on. So I'm pretty sure that with the Royal Library, that, you know, I don't have any direct proof for this, but I have a strong suspicion that for the Royal Library, one of the reasons he gave the Royal Library officials the ability to criticize without being criticized in return is he wanted to criticize certain officials. And so he probably sort of told them, some of those, you know, library officials, I want you to criticize this person, like write a memorial saying that this guy's doing bad stuff, because that gives Chengdu then an excuse to fire that person if he wants to do it.
So he has these mechanisms which he's developing and exploiting, and he uses them to affect changes that he wants in the Korean system. And you spent a chapter talking about his military reforms. What was he doing with those, with the military, and why were these reforms so significant?
Well, that's a great question, because that's actually the part that within Korean studies is the most neglected. As I was saying before, I hope that, you know, absolutism and such can be a good addition to kind of the larger conversation about absolutism. But really, when you look at Korean studies, the Chosun military is horribly neglected. And that's partly because, yes, for most of the Chosun period, which is about a 500-year period of Korea's history, the country was mostly at peace. This military was relatively small and probably not a very effective military. But even that considered, there's still important things about the military that we should be looking at. So I'm glad I had the opportunity to write about this, because it's kind of the most, in some ways, the most radical of what Chengdu was doing. Because in ancient times, Korea had, you know, it was divided into three kingdoms. And they were warrior aristocracies. So the king led from the front. The king was expected to be a general, and Korean kings died in battle. But by the time you get to Chosun, the country is thoroughly Confucianized. So the military is distinctly a lesser branch of the government, much less respected than civilian officials were. So, and therefore not very effective. I mean, just like in Korea today, right? Nobody wants to serve in the military. It's a thankless task. Today in South Korea, it disrupts young men's career trajectory. It disrupts their education. And they essentially don't get paid. I mean, they do receive a salary, but it's such a pit. It's like $150 per month. I consider that to be the equivalent of zero. So essentially, they're not actually paid. You know, I mean, they're taken care of. Their needs are taken care of, but they don't receive any pay for 2 whole years. So nobody wants to do that, right? And it's the same way in Chosun. You know, when you went to serve in the army, when it was your turn to do like your few months or whatever in the military, you also were not paid. And in Chosun, you weren't even taken care of. So you would go to the fort, you know, wherever your assigned post was, and your family had to bring you food, or you had to find some way to get food for yourself. You weren't actually fed by the state. Or if you were, it wasn't very reliable. So people didn't want to serve in the military, and the great Yangban clans didn't want their sons to become generals. So you had this sort of separation between the powerful Yangban clans, the richest and most powerful ones, and they're all civilian officials, and you had, you know, a group of clans who were like, you know, the French, you know, nobles of the sword, you know, the robes of the sword, the ones that inherit through their military prowess. Except unlike in France, the sword nobles would have been the lesser ones. They would have been the less respected ones. And so the king of Chosun was not expected to be very martial. But Chongzhou would do things to remind his officials that in the end he was actually the commander of the military. So he engaged in a number of military parades and demonstrations in which he would appear in armor. He was well known as apparently a very good archer. Now, of course, they exaggerated how good he was. They said, you know, he'd hit the target 99 times out of 100, which is probably not true. But still, he was, you know, all king. They didn't say that all kings were good archers. So the fact that they noted that he was a good archer means he probably was, even if they exaggerated it. And we know that his officials were in fact intimidated, because they told us. So some of his political opponents would say, you know, you keep having these military parades where you appear in armor, and some of us are getting kind of scared about that. And the reason he is doing this is because, you know, two kings of Chosun, during the 500 years, they were overthrown, not through royal infighting. You know, it's not one brother against another brother, though that did also happen. But two times it happened, but it was the officials. It was the officials of the country had decided that the king had been ruling tyrannically, or had done some violation of what they considered to be what the king is supposed to do. And so since the king doesn't directly command the army, it's not like a, you know, it's through layers of officials. And so the officials actually could command the king's own army against him. And so Chongzhou knew that. And his grandfather had suffered a rebellion of the same thing. It was not, you know, a peasant rebellion. It was not a rebellion from his, you know, brother or cousin trying to take the throne. No, it was officials that thought that that he was going to persecute them. So they decided to move first and try to have him overthrown. And it didn't work. And in fact, it probably didn't have much hope of working. But at the time it was going on, it looked very dangerous. You know, we now know that they handled it pretty easily. But it was a shock to the king, to Chongzhou's grandfather, who was, because it was very, very early in his reign. He was very young. He's very insecure. And then he gets this rebellion, which looks like it was really major and really dangerous. And so even though Chongzhou's grandfather ruled the country for 52 years, he still remembered, you know, that those first couple of years when we had this terrible rebellion that he thought was maybe the end of his kingship, the end of his life, the end of his family's rule of the country. So when Chongzhou became king, he was concerned about this possibility that military officials, or that the officials had this control of the military. So he built a gigantic fortress, which was supposed to protect the tomb of his father from robbery. And that was pretty common to do, to build like a little fort for a few soldiers to prevent grave robbery. But he built it into this giant fortress, which it still exists in the city of Suwon, which is now a suburb of Seoul today. They used to be two separate cities, but Seoul keeps growing. So now it's a suburb of Seoul. It's mostly been restored. A lot of it's not original, but it is mostly still there. And it's you know, this giant fortress that runs throughout the downtown part of Suwon. And then he assigned to it a new military unit he had created that was directly under the command of the governor of Suwon. So it's not in the normal military hierarchy. And Chongzhou consistently appointed to that office. And because it's the governor of a major city, it means it reports directly to the king. And so he always put a key supporter of his in that position. So essentially what he's done is he's created a separate military unit that's directly loyal to the king and is defending a fortress that he could flee to if necessary. And another way that we can suspect that that's what he was doing is because that military unit was immediately disbanded after he died. It was supposedly too expensive. So they got rid of it after he died because they recognized that giving the king separate military power made him potentially more independent than the officials wanted.
The fact that they disband this unit right after his death raises a very interesting question, which is how effective were his efforts to strengthen the power of the Korean monarchy? What was his long-term legacy for Korean government and for Korea more generally?
Yeah, that's a question that I think even my book doesn't really answer. It more poses that question. I mean, I give an answer, but I don't in any way consider it to be definitive. And so I really hope that another consequence, I have big ambitions for this book. Another thing I hope will happen is that people will look at it and investigate Chongzhou a little more and maybe come up with a more comprehensive and a better answer as to what exactly his legacy ends up being. I don't pretend to be the final word on it, but I would say that his legacy was, he was very effective at his goal of relative royal strength and independence while he was alive. But I don't think he did a very good job of, in fact, I think he pretty much failed at instituting that. So his legacy in that way is he created a system that needed a powerful central presence. And when there wasn't one in the form of his son, it became one in the form of what we modern scholars refer to as in-law family governance. They didn't use that term then. But what that means is it became an issue of who could marry their, which powerful clan could marry their daughter, one of their daughters, to the future king. And once they did that, then they kind of secured their clan's dominance of the government, which traditionally we've always considered to be bad. And we consider it to be bad, I think, because of our inheritance of Confucianism, which, as I mentioned before, for a Confucian scholar, taking over the king's position is usurpation. It's not the proper way of things. So it's usually been seen as negative. Oh, the 19th century is bad because the kings are not ruling. Instead, the in-law family, so the queen's clan, is kind of dominating the government. But in the end, we really have to look at that and kind of reevaluate it and say, was that really so bad? Because there was a lot less bloodshed. Instead of the really painful factional disputes that would often find, you know, people being executed, as I said, this posthumous taking people's offices, posthumously even desecrating their corpses, that's went way down. The struggle between the different in-law families became very, very much more like kind of dangerous liaisons kind of thing, like ruining people's reputations, outwitting them in marriage partnerships and alliances, and much less about just openly having people killed. And the government seems to have functioned. I mean, there were famines in the 1830s and into the 1850s, which is not good, but these are famines caused by weather, not caused by human mismanagement, but caused by weather. And the government seemed to still be effective in fighting them, because the government had storehouses where they stored grain in bumper crops. When it was a good year, then they would have this grain stored, and then in a bad year, they don't give it away for free, unfortunately, but they would sell it at what the normal price was, instead of, you know, an inflated, you know, when there's a bad year, then the price of what rice you have goes way up and people can't afford it. So the government had these, that's why they call them ever normal granaries. So that means they keep the price of rice normal. So they would sell it at a reasonable price people could afford. So this famine relief measure still seemed to be functioning throughout the 19th century. So maybe the 19th century is actually not as bad as we've been led to believe. So it may turn out that paradoxically, by failing, Chongzhou succeeded, because by not successfully instituting an absolutist government, he instead instituted a in-law government that was much less contentious, much less riven with strife and infighting and political violence, and struggling over controlling or trying to control an absolute king, or the absolute king trying to escape that control, and actually might have contributed to the government functioning better, or at least as well as it had before, even with fewer resources. But again, that is in no way the definitive conclusion. I invite anyone with interest to take up that mantle and look at it more closely. But that's what I think may end up being that, and the fortress, the fortress in Suwon, which remains today. It's the most physical legacy that you can see. Still remains today. Hmm.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before you go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Right now, I'm working on a very ambitious project, which a lot of people don't know or are only vaguely aware, that Korea was a slave society for the majority of its history. And when I say slave society, what I mean, for anybody who's not familiar with that, the term as used in slavery studies, it doesn't just mean a society that has slaves. I mean, that describes most human societies, sadly. Most human societies have, to at least some extent, involved the ownership and trade of people and their labor. But most human societies, you know, as bad as what I just said is, at the very least, it was usually a small part of their of the overall population. I mean, you know, there's various degrees of lack of freedom. You know, for most of human society, most people haven't really been what we would call free, but most of the time they were also not slaves. So, you know, in China, the percentage was probably only like 8% at the absolute highest. Usually it's probably more like 2%. Japan, less than 1%. So, you know, it's usually, you know, slavery is terrible for anyone to be under, but at least it wasn't a huge number of people. But then when we talk about a slave society, that usually means between, depending on which scholar you ask, between 20 and 30%. So like the American South, you know, before the Civil War, it was about 30%. Ancient Rome was, you know, relatively the same number of slaves. According to most estimates, Korea in the Joseon period and probably in the period before that was a slave society. It also had about 30%. There were villages where 70% of the population were slaves. And so not only is this unusual just because slave societies are pretty rare in world history, but it appears to be the only one in Asia. And it's sitting right between China and Japan, neither of which was a slave society. It was a Confucian society, which China also was. Yet apparently Korean Confucianism permitted not only slavery, but wide scale, large scale slavery, and somehow the Korean scholars didn't see a conflict between that. So my next project is, as I said, it's going to be quite ambitious, because I'm trying to look at a very broad view of Korean slavery with the intent of introducing it, because Korean scholars know this already, but with the intent of introducing it to a more international audience. Hey guys, by the way, if you didn't know, here's possibly the only slave society in Asia. How do we explain that? You know, whatever, you know, theories that we have of slavery. And if it sounds vague, it's because it is, because I'm only just getting into the first part of it. Anybody who might be interested in that, next year, there's a book coming out, which I believe is called Slavery and Unfree Labor in Asia. That's probably not the exact title, but it's something like that, edited by Richard Allen. And it's got a chapter in there that I've done, which is kind of the results of the preliminary work I've done, where I just sort of a chapter length sort of overview of Korean slavery, you know, situated against other slavery in Asia. So hopefully that's going to be out next year. So I've only just gotten into to doing it, which is why it sounds kind of vague, but it's, yeah, a sort of introduction to Korean slavery for the non-Korea specialist.
Well, sounds like a very interesting project, and maybe when it's complete, we can have you back on the New Books Network.
Oh, that'd be great.
Well, Christopher Levins, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.